Hello, and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth, where we recap some of the biggest stories in the world of RIAs. I'm Alex Steger, and as ever, I'm joined by Ian Wenig.
Thanks for having me. You know, I've received some very interesting reviews about our opening banter. Our founder loves it, but my wife said, if you don't mention me in the intro, I'm going to be very mad at you. There are going to be serious consequences. So I had to fulfill that promise to her.
Well, you've mentioned her, although I don't know in the most flattering way, so you might want to reconsider how you mention her, but we'll keep it in for now, and we update us next week on whether it went well or not. Well, as well as Ian and his wife, we're also joined today by Sam Bojarski. Sam, welcome back to the pod after being away for a whole 1 week. How have you been? How did you cope?
Yeah, it's been a rough week. But great to be back.
Heavy withdrawal symptoms, I imagine.
Yeah, big time.
Excellent. Well, look, thank you both for being here. And we're going to kick off today by discussing, Sam, a story that you wrote, but Ian, something that you're also very familiar with. And that is the story of Steward Partners. And Sam, your story, which is effectively about them halting recruitment for its 1099 affiliation model. So, before we get into all the details, let's start with the basics. Give us a quick skinny on Steward Partners for those less familiar with it, and then what is the 1099 model as opposed to, I think, the other most common model, the W-2 model?
Yeah. So Steward Partners, they're a hybrid RIA broker-dealer founded around 2013 by ex-Morgan Stanley executives. And like several other firms out there, they offer advisors the opportunity to affiliate in a couple different ways, one being a 1099 or independent contractor model, and then the other being W-2, where advisors are full-time employees.
Okay, so very quickly, when we say who was founded by, if you're very interested in that story, have a look at an article that CityWire wrote in, when was it, Ian? Probably 2020?
It was late 2020. It was published early 2021, I believe,
by Jake Martin. Colleague Jake Martin, the great Jake Martin, I think we can say it. Anyway, very interesting story. Massive side note, though. So let's get back to it. So talk to me about the differences between those two models, Sam, quickly.
Yeah, so the 1099 or independent contractor model, advisors can affiliate, they can put their assets on Steward Partners ADV, but they're essentially running their own business as entrepreneurs, and they're getting quite a high percentage of their of the revenues they generate relative to the W-2 model.
Okay, so you under the 1099 model, you keep more of what you make, and you effectively pay a portion of it for some level of support or service from, in this case, Steward. It could be another firm.
Exactly.
Whereas W-2 model, you're a full-on employee. So you, and under that model, you effectively keep less of what you make, but you depend on the firm for more.
Yeah. Firm covers all the technology, the office supplies, everything like that. I mean, the W-2 model, advisors might take home, let's say, like 50% of their annual revenues, versus maybe in the 1099 model, they might take home north of 80%.
Okay, fantastic. And within Steward, there are about 200 advisors, is that correct?
Yep, about 200 advisors.
Combining for about 38 billion of client assets. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we said before, we don't know the breakdown between those two models within the firm, but going forwards, any new firm joining will only be able to be a W-2 employee, but the existing 1099s obviously can stay.
That's right. Yeah, they're not recruiting anymore for their 1099 model. So, most everyone will be a W-2 going forward if they join.
And to cut into the chase, what's the rationale for this? So why are they doing it?
Yeah, firms are just having trouble with the margins on the 1099 business. You know, it's tougher to link firm growth with the growth of the advisor's own business on the 1099 model, because the advisor himself or herself is taking more a cut of their revenue. So it's just, in many cases, just not as profitable for the firm.
But so why initially would you not just have just a W-2 model? Why would firms, when they start, offer both if one is, you know, a much lower margin model?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we've like talked about this before on this podcast, like just the sheer scale of like transition between from wirehouses to RIAs, and a lot of firms want to capture as much of a share of that as they can. So they want to attract, you know, for instance, like entrepreneurial minded advisors who might be leaving a wirehouse or a bank with a 1099 model. So they're trying to capture more market share there.
Yeah, and I guess when you start, you just want to get some assets through the door, build a business, so you're a little bit more open about the kind of firms that you might have.
Exactly. Yeah, and some of them, you know, might just want to be employees, obviously.
Yeah, of course. And so the move that Stuart's making, is there something else going on here? Why are they effectively sort of fine-tuning the business to some degree, focusing on a more profitable area? Ian, maybe I'll bring you in here because this might relate to a story that you wrote last week.
Yeah, so we reported last week that Steward was pursuing a sale of a controlling stake in the company, that they'd hired Piper Sandler to serve as their investment banker. So when you hire the banker, obviously it's getting pretty serious. And I think just to what Sam said, the profit margins that you get from W-2 advisors on the platform as opposed to 1099 contractors who might be doing a lot of brokerage business, it's staggering. So for example, I can't name the firm, but a couple of weeks ago I had the pleasure of looking at the financials of a brokerage firm that had similar advisor characteristics to Steward.
Can I just pause you there? It's not a phrase you hear that often. I had the pleasure of looking at the financials, but you know, this is the kind of dedication that we at CDYRIA have to our work, dear listener. Carry on, Ian. Sorry.
And it was fascinating because this firm had multiple times more 1099 contractor brokerage assets than it did pure RIA W-2 employee assets. But the W-2 advisory business comprised 45% of the company's earnings, despite being about 1/6 of its total assets under management or administration. So it makes sense why you'd want to concentrate your business around a higher margin channel, and then you try to get your earnings multiple based off of that high margin channel as opposed to the contractor business.
Got it. So there's maybe a little bit of sort of vanity sanity kind of dynamic at play there. And then going back to your the story that you wrote last week then, so Stuart is pursuing a sale of a majority rather than a minority stake. Not something they confirmed to us, but something that we heard from sources to a degree that we were confident in. So what's its current ownership situation and how are they looking to change that?
So it's a split. You have a significant chunk owned by its management, including some of its co-founders. And then you have the Prisk organization. You might recognize that name if you've ever stayed in a Hyatt hotel, or if you're a listener from Illinois, it's the very same multi-billionaire Pritzker family. They have a minority position. And then the Cynosure Group, which is a private equity firm tied to the first multi-millionaire family in Utah, also has a minority stake. So they have multiple private stakeholders who could get a significant exit, as well as founders who might be looking to retire who can get some significant liquidity through a sale of a majority stake.
Okay, so we think all three groups would be looking to sell some equity in that kind of deal.
Yeah, it would make sense they'd want to take chips off the table, especially if you think about just how far the market has come and the valuations in this industry have come from 2021, 2022 to 24, 25 now.
Got it. And to your point, our conjecture, because I suppose, let's be honest, it is that it's not a coincidence that they're tightening their model and emphasizing the W-2 model around the same time that they're looking for investors to buy into the firm.
Doesn't shock me.
I suppose one question I did have was just on this shift. Have we seen other firms make this shift too? Ian, you mentioned an unnamed firm that, you know, obviously makes more money from the W-2 model. We're seeing Steward make this move. Have other firms done something similar in the past?
Yeah, it's a playbook that we've seen before. I mean, Kestra Financial is a good example where they built their own RIA aggregation division called Blue Spring Wealth Partners. And a lot of what Blue Spring did was they would buy Kestra 1099 contractor affiliated advisory practice or brokerage practices, and they'd bring it all in-house. So the advisors stay affiliated. They'll have to change custodians or repaper. But the financial split is a little bit more favorable to Kestra itself. And the advisors do get a substantial payout for selling their practice and selling that advantageous payout. Another example would be Hightower Advisors. So after Thomas H. Lee Partners came in and bought a large stake in the firm in 2017, Hightower used a lot of that capital that it had raised from THL to basically buy down a lot of the existing affiliate advisory practices to give them more control. I mean, I think you see a lot of these valuations. The reason that RIA valuations pop more than brokerage valuations is because, one, advisory business is inherently higher margin than brokerage business, but two, advisory assets are inherently stickier than brokerage assets. So it makes sense why you'd want to get people as W-2 employees. It makes it a lot easier to keep the assets on the platform. And as you've seen from some of our other coverage, if those W-2 advisors leave and take assets with them, you usually see a lawsuit filed in federal or state court going after them.
Got it. So effectively, it's more profitable, but also more integrated and stickier business. And all in all, a hell of a lot more attractive if you're trying to sell said business than the alternative.
What you described is why I like to read financial reports for fun.
Brilliant. There you go. Fantastic. Well, thank you both for bringing me and indeed our listeners up to speed on events at Stewart. Another big deal, though, we touched on the Stewart deal. Ian, I also wanted to talk about was Commonwealth Financial. So in this case, mostly a broker, but also broker and RA model. But a big story this week. Can you bring us up to speed on that?
Yeah, so we reported, citing a lot of sources familiar with the situation, that Commonwealth has entered the M&A market. They're a very closely held company, but they're going for institutional outside capital for, I believe, the first time. And they've retained Goldman Sachs to help them find a new minority investor. I mean, this is a company that has hundreds of billions of dollars in advisory and brokerage assets, about $296 billion as of the end of 2023. And obviously that number has gone up since then. So you'd expect, even if a large chunk of that is brokerage business, that they'd still be able to get a valuation in the billions from whatever private equity firm or sovereign wealth fund or strategic investor chooses to buy a stake in that company.
And you mentioned it's closely held. And to the best of our knowledge, it hasn't raised money from private equity before. Is that fair? With the caveat that that's what we know, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. So they have, the ownership is basically split between 12 partners, including the founder, Joseph Deitch, and then three partners emeritus.
And that makes it, I would say, something of a rare beast, right? Because pretty much all the big broker dealers that are, you know, not public, like an LPL or something, and all the larger RIAs at this point have some sort of external investor or strategic investor, and for the most part that's been PE.
They are a bit of a unicorn. I mean, you said LPL is public now, but they went through private equity investment. A lot of Commonwealth's biggest competitors, Kestra, which we mentioned, they're private equity backed. Cetera, they're private equity backed. So it's kind of shocking that they're one of the last ones standing. I mean, another example that stands out to me in the RIA world is a Moneta Group, which is closely held by its employees. And they're out there, but they're increasingly a rare breed. The Siberian Tigers of the wealth world.
Yeah, exactly. So I can't imagine that they're going to be short of offers for what they're looking for.
I'd imagine it'd be a fairly competitive process.
Fantastic. Well, look, two huge stories, guys. And thanks for getting me up to speed on that. Now, we haven't got anything to do with reality TV to discuss this week, but any other sort of drama going on in the RIA world that we should be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned, I talked a little bit earlier about this idea of the lawsuits when W-2 employees leave. And it was kind of striking to me just how deep this legal conflict between Edelman Financial Engines and Mariner Wealth Advisors has gotten, where Edelman, at the end of last week, filed an amended complaint in which they accuse Mariner CEO majority owner Marty Bicknell of personally recruiting at least one advisor to leave Edelman and join Mariner. And so, you know, that recruiting is recruiting, but I think what these lawsuits kind of speak to is the nature of the beast when it comes to being owned by private equity, because so much of your valuation and their investment thesis is based on the stickiness of those assets. And if you have advisors leaving, and you don't set a precedent that you're going to fight to keep those assets on the platform, you're going to see an exodus.
Yeah, that's really interesting. This might be unfair, Ian, so I'm going to put you on the spot and you can resent me for it, both now and forever. But that lawsuit's been running for a long time. How long and what's at stake? Can you remember any of these facts off the top of your head?
Yeah, so they accused, they've accused Merit of running a serial.
They being Edelman.
Yes, them being Edelman. I believe that the complaint dates to, because I haven't read about it as much, it might be early 24 or late 23.
Yeah, I think it was late 23. I think it was around November of 2023.
Yeah, and some portions of Edelman's complaint were dismissed. So this isn't exactly a complete win from one side or the other. But, you know, this isn't the only one that we've seen. I mean, LPL, we've mentioned before, they're in litigation with Ameriprise.
Yeah, that's been going on for a long time, yeah.
Yes. You know, Mariner, they've been in litigation with Savvy Advisors. So you're seeing this play out at multiple levels and multiple channels across the wealth management business.
And it's always been something of a fact. I mean, obviously, there was for a long time the if I could speak properly, the broker protocol, which obviously between the sort of the wirehouses, which effectively was there to negate tit for tat lawsuits because otherwise it would have just happened every week with them, right? But such a thing doesn't exist in the RIA world. And as you say, Ian, the stakes are higher than ever in this space because so much is, on a very literal level, invested in keeping those advisors at those firms, keeping those assets in place.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think back to a story that we wrote during COVID, actually, where the premise was, is the RIA business looking more like the brokerage world? And I think the answer is kind of undeniably yes, because look at what we're seeing right now. You have these firms with tens, hundreds of billion dollars in assets suing each other over poaching campaigns. I mean, this is what we saw before the broker protocol went into effect.
Yeah, and all the more reason why, to bring this full circle, almost like we planned it, all the more reason why to, you know, to emphasize that W-2 model and have your advisors as employees.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. There's more restrictions on their movement that way.
Well, I was going to say fantastic, but it feels odd to say fantastic after the phrase restrictions on movement. But anyway, I think we've covered a lot of ground there. We've covered some of the biggest stories that we've written this week, and indeed, dare I say, some of the biggest stories in this space. Ian and Sam, thank you both very much indeed for your time. Listener, thank you, and we'll be back again next Friday. See you then.